Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key of the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for tuning in today. And if you're new here, we appreciate you checking out our podcast. We hope you decide to stick around. And if you are listening for the first time, our existing listeners know this, but the premise of our podcast is that I research a different unsolved case each week, and then I present it to you guys and to Sean, and it's his first time hearing the case. He doesn't know anything about it, so we discuss as we go. You can find us on Instagram at Key to the Case Podcast, and you can reach us by email as well at keythecase@gmail.com. All right, let's get into today's case. Louise Chaput was 52 years old at the time of her murder in 2001. Louise lived in the city of Sherbrooke in Canada's largest province, Quebec, with her longtime boyfriend, who is sometimes referred to as her husband, and two daughters, one who was 10 at the time of her murder and another who was 19. Known for her quick wit and dynamic personality, Louise was easy to like. I noticed when researching that there were a lot of interviews with friends, and you could tell they had a close relationship with Louise. They really seemed more like family than friends. Louise was an experienced psychologist with a private practice where she specialized in family and marital counseling, but leading up to her murder, she was employed on a contract basis at a detention facility in Sherbrooke. Louise was responsible for counseling a half a dozen inmates who were operating as police informants within the facility, unbeknownst to their fellow inmates. This contract position provided a fresh way for Louise to apply her experience. And although she didn't talk about it often, she seemed to genuinely enjoy it. She was even called to testify as an expert witness in youth court from time to time. Louise was described as intelligent, and she was passionate about her work. Despite her expertise in the field, she always welcomed the opinions of others who worked in her profession. She understood the importance of remaining open to the insights of her peers. Louise even offered free counseling to low-income families through various agencies in her community. We often talk about how victims impacted their family and friends, but with Louise's line of work, she had the opportunity to positively impact her clients too. Louise has been described as an outdoor enthusiast. She grew up in a family where skiing and hiking were regular weekend activities, and she carried that love for being outdoors and in the mountains with her for the rest of her life. One of Louise's friends shared that during a cross-country skiing outing, no one could match her pace. Her athleticism stood out. On Thursday, November 15th, 2001, Louise had plans to travel down to New Hampshire, specifically the White Mountain National Forest, for a weekend of hiking. She initially had plans to take a trip abroad with several friends, but considering 9/11 had just happened a couple of months before, they canceled their travel plans. The White Mountain National Forest spans nearly 800,000 acres, with the majority of the land in New Hampshire, with a small portion in western Maine. Louise planned to visit the Pinkham Notch area, where there would be plenty of hiking trails to choose from, and with this area being a 2.5 to 3 hour drive from Sherbrooke, it was the perfect spot for a long weekend trip. Plus, Louise had visited the area before and thought it was beautiful, and there was also the appeal of it being a different country and speaking a different language. Quebec's official language is French, so that was Louise's primary language, but she did speak English as well.
So this is pretty much the beginning of the off season for hiking trails, right? I would assume the busiest time of year for these hiking trails is going to be in the summer leading into fall, but beginning of winter, I'd imagine the ski resorts start opening up again and they transition over from a lot of hikers to skiers.
Exactly. Yeah. Mid-November or November in general would be considered part of the off season in the White Mountains. And like you said, most visitors are coming to the area during the late summer and early fall months, especially for hiking. And then during the winter months when there's plenty of snow for skiing and other winter sports, that attracts a lot of people too.
So these hiking trails probably aren't going to be super busy.
Right. You would expect the occasional hiker like Louise, who isn't deterred by November being kind of the off season, right? Of course, you can visit any time of year, but yeah, this would not be a super popular time for the area she was visiting. But I mean, that could make it appealing for someone like Louise because there would be fewer people around and it would be much quieter than the peak seasons. But as that Thursday, November 15th approached and Louise asked a few people to join her on the hiking expedition, no one was able to, but she had already arranged to be away from work. And as passionate as she was about her work, she was looking forward to a break. So she decided to go it alone.
Was it standard for her to go on these trips alone, or did she typically go with friends or were her family?
Yeah, this was no big deal for Louise. She was very independent. And I suppose it may have helped that she'd been to the area before and had some familiarity with it. But it sounded like she would have gone regardless. Like her family and friends remembered her taking trips alone. And yeah, it was just no big deal for her. So Louise began her drive that Thursday around mid-morning and passed through the Canadian border in Norton, Vermont at 11:45 a.m. About an hour later, at 12:50 p.m., Louise stopped at a convenience store and gas station once she made it to New Hampshire in the town of Colebrook, where she made a purchase. If Louise left the convenience store and headed straight to the area she'd be hiking in, that drive would take about an hour and a half, so she'd arrive there around 2:30. And based on what we know happened next, Louise most likely didn't make any other stops along the way. A clerk at the Appalachian Mountain Club Visitors Center spoke with who was believed to be Louise around 3 p.m. Louise had a reservation to stay at the Joe Dodge Lodge, which the Appalachian Mountain Club runs over the next few days. And this was the visitor center in that area near the hiking trails Louise would be using. But to my knowledge, it would have been a little too early for her to check into her room. So the clerk recalled Louise inquiring about a short hike she could do before the sunset. She indicated she'd been driving for a while, which bolsters the idea that this was Louise. Plus, possibly even more important, the woman matched her description, including having a French accent. So it's believed that this was Louise. The clerk recommended she hike the Lost Pond Trail across from the center, which would take just about 30 to 45 minutes, depending on her speed. Louise seemed to think it was a good idea and left the visitor center.
Yeah, even if she could have checked in, she probably wouldn't have just just because she wanted to get a hike in before the sunset.
Exactly. And she was running out of time because we have to keep in mind, this is November. It's already around 3 p.m. Granted, if she does this hike, that's only 30 to 45 minutes. She should be fine. But yeah, she's definitely getting close to the point where the sun would be setting. That was the last known sighting of Louise alive. The last interaction she had with anyone that we know of other than her killer. And I should add that the weather was unusually mild for the time of year. At lower elevations, there was very little snow when she arrived, so it was a good day for hiking. Louise planned to return home on Monday, November 19th. So when she didn't return and didn't show up for work, her boyfriend was deeply concerned and reported her as a missing person.
So did they not communicate that entire weekend? Did they not call each other on the phone or anything?
No, they didn't talk that weekend. And he hadn't expected to hear from her over the weekend. I don't know if Louise had a cell phone. It was 2001, so maybe she did, maybe she didn't. But yeah, he didn't really expect to hear from her that weekend.
Yeah, I guess I just kind of assumed that she, after getting done with a hike, you know, once she's settling back into her lodge, she would have called her boyfriend and told him how it went and if she saw anything cool or just kind of to check in.
Well, as you'll find out, she didn't have the chance to, most likely. So we have this combination of she wasn't able to do that. I don't know if she would or she wouldn't have, but he clearly wasn't expecting her to check in with him all weekend. So that's why when Monday came around and she didn't return, that's when he reported her missing. And I believe he reported her missing to the local authorities, and then they contacted law enforcement in New Hampshire once they learned she traveled there, so they could handle the investigation for the most part from there. By the next day, Tuesday, family and friends of Louise traveled to her last known location, and the searches were underway. Various agencies were involved in the searches, including Fish and Game Rescue, Mountain Rescue Service, the U.S. Forest Service, as well as the Army National Guard, which deployed a helicopter to conduct aerial searches. Although the weather was mild when Louise arrived, by Tuesday, that wasn't the case any longer. Searchers on foot contended with high winds, swirling snow, and wind chills around negative 16 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 26 degrees Celsius. To me, that kind of weather is nearly unbearable. If I go outside and it feels like negative 16 degrees, my goal is to get back inside as quickly as possible. So it had to be difficult to be out there searching for hours and hours, but they needed to find Louise.
So did the police ever check in with the lodge clerk to see if Louise ever made it back to the room or if they saw each other in passing or anything along those lines?
Yes. And they found out that she did not check in to her room. So that was helpful, I guess, in narrowing down the timeline of like, okay, she arrived around 3 on Thursday. She was going to go for this short hike. So she should have checked into her room a couple of hours later, and she never checked into that room. And no one reported seeing her after that 3 o'clock time frame. And apparently, if people don't check into their room, there's no process of trying to contact them. I'm not really sure because it's not like her boyfriend got a call from the lodge saying she never checked in.
Right. They probably just mark it down as a no-show or something.
Right. And I imagine that happens from time to time, people not showing up for their reservation. So it didn't seem like they took any extra steps to find out why she missed it. They finally made progress on Wednesday when they found Louise's car, a silver 2001 Ford Focus station wagon. Her car was parked in the Daratisma Trail parking lot, just about a mile south of the lodge. This parking lot also functions as overflow parking for the visitor center. And the location of her car is interesting because it's not believed she was going to hike on the Daratisma Trail point to point. That trail is about 230 miles or 370 kilometers. So She definitely wasn't doing the full hike. But I also said this served as overflow parking for the visitor center, which was not busy at that time. So it's not like she would have needed to use that parking. Although it was across the way from the Lost Pond Trail that the clerk at the visitor center recommended. So that could be why she parked there. I was also surprised it took them more than a day to find her car, since most of these trailhead parking lots were empty at that time. So you'd think her car would stand out, but it could be that they missed that parking lot in the beginning. You could suggest that the car wasn't there on Tuesday when they were searching. It was placed there sometime before they found it. But at this point, I don't know that there's any evidence to support that or any explanation of why someone would do that. Inside Louise's car, law enforcement made a few telling discoveries. They found a receipt from the convenience store in Colebrook, New Hampshire. So that's how they knew she made a stop after entering the United States and before arriving in the Pinkham Notch area. There was food in Louise's car, along with her hiking boots and a small pack with chocolate and water. And she always hiked with chocolate and water. I guess that was her thing. So these items being left behind could indicate that Louise didn't get the chance to go on a hike, that something happened to her before she could. However, it has been posited by some that because she was going for a short hike, she just wore her sneakers, so she wouldn't necessarily need to wear her hiking boots for a shorter hike. And she could have opted to leave behind the chocolate and water. So I guess either scenario is possible.
Yeah, I don't think it's that unusual for her to have left her hiking boots and the water and chocolate in the car. I mean, yes, she was going on a hike and she usually brought that stuff, but this seemed like it would have been a really short hike, like I think you said 30 to 45 minutes. So I guess the weirdest part is not putting on the hiking boots. It only takes, you know, probably only takes 30 seconds to throw those on. But yeah, not bringing the water or the chocolate doesn't seem too outlandish to me, since she wasn't going to be gone that long. And once she got back to her car, she kind of rehydrated and had a little bit of chocolate.
Yeah. When I heard the hiking boots were still in her car, I didn't think that was a super clear indicator that she didn't make it on the hike. To me, I'm on the same page as you. Like, if she was wearing sneakers, which we'll find out she was, it's a short hike. She probably could have managed, considering there wasn't a lot of snow on the ground. It sounded like the terrain would have allowed her to do this short hike in her sneakers. Obviously, it's not preferred, but I guess if she was trying to get on that hike quickly, then maybe she wanted to save time or just didn't think they were necessary to wear. But on the other hand, you could look at it as she just never got the chance to go on the hike. The day after the discovery of Louise's car, Thursday, November 22nd, was Thanksgiving Day that year in the U.S. I'm specifying the U.S. because Canada observes a holiday in October. And it marked 1 week since the last sighting of Louise. It was also the day fish and game searchers finally found Louise. Louise's frozen body was recovered around 4 p.m. that day, covered in leaves in a clearing in the woods off the Glen Boulder Trail. Sources vary on the exact distance from the trail. Some say 200 feet, others say a quarter mile, but the most commonly reported distance of how far off the trail she was is 200 yards. And I also read that you could see the trail from where Louise's body was located. She was also about a quarter mile from where her car was parked.
So how far was this from where the clerk recommended she start her hike?
It's right across the street from that one, the Lost Pond Trail. And the Glen Boulder Trail, the one she was found a distance off of, is a popular one to hike, but would be a little more challenging and take longer than the Lost Pond Trail. Louise was found wearing black fleece pants, white Reebok sneakers, a quarter-length red nylon jacket, and a herringbone-style sterling silver necklace. The medical examiner determined during the autopsy that Louise's manner of death was homicide, and she died from multiple stab wounds. The murder weapon passed through her clothing, but the extent of her injuries, such as how many stab wounds she received and where on her body she was stabbed, has remained undisclosed. However, law enforcement has shared that they believe Louise was murdered shortly after arriving in the area and that it was clear there was a struggle. They could tell Louise fought for her life. It makes sense that she would have been killed shortly after arriving in the area because she never showed up for her reservation at the lodge and wasn't planning to take a long hike. So it comes back to the question of, did she go hiking and someone targeted her on a trail, or did they come in contact with her before she had the chance to start a hike? The authorities have not shared if there were signs of sexual assault. We know Louise was fully clothed, so that could be a sign that sexual assault was not a factor, but that's certainly not conclusive. I learned something about Louise's murder toward the end of my research that was quite shocking. So two Canadian journalists, Julianne Morissette and Boris Prue, investigated and researched Louise's murder and even covered it in a season of their long-form true crime podcast that's in French. They learned a lot of information from Louise's family and friends, and one detail the family shared was that Louise's body was burned and she was covered in an accelerant. I'm not sure the extent of the burns, but based on the fact that her clothes were still intact, it sounded like, and they could tell she was stabbed, I can't imagine the fire was long burning or caused extensive damage, but this could point to the killer wanting to destroy evidence. It definitely adds to the violent nature of this homicide. Law enforcement has not clarified if the spot she was found in is the exact spot she was killed in, or if it was a secondary location. If that spot is where she was killed, then how did she get deep into the woods like that? What comes to mind is a potential chase situation where Louise is trying to get away from her attacker. She entered the woods and they caught up with her. Otherwise, that is a considerable distance for someone to carry a body alone in the situation where she was killed somewhere else and then moved to that spot. For example, if she were killed on the Glen Boulder Trail, that person would have to carry or drag her 200 yards or the length of two football fields until they left her. So there should have been clear signs if that's the case. But again, law enforcement hasn't completely clarified that. Louise's murder came as a shock to her family and friends. It was jarring enough to learn she was dead, but to then learn she was murdered was almost incomprehensible. Louise's daughters and friends have said that Louise's boyfriend, who was also the father of her younger daughter, had a very difficult time. Losing Louise was an extremely painful experience, and while he wasn't as publicly vocal about the case, he was completely cooperative with the investigation and helpful with the police. But the violence of it all was hard to process. Louise was so precious and special to him, so to lose her in this way was unimaginable. Law enforcement and people who lived in the community were shocked by Louise's murder, too. It was widely reported that the last White Mountain unsolved homicide was 24 years prior in 1977 when 22-year-old Sherry Roth was strangled to death. Her unclothed body was found on the Sawyer Brook Trail in New Hampshire on the opposite side of Mount Washington from where Louise was. Sherry was hiking alone when killed, and her murder has yet to be solved. The generally accepted thought was that hikers should be more worried about experiencing a weather-related accident or a dangerous fall than becoming a victim of foul play, which is statistically accurate. And it's pretty remarkable because at that time, it was reported that 6.5 to 7 million people visited the forest each year and were not victims of violent crime. The investigators also looked into murders that occurred on the Appalachian Trail because Luis was near the Appalachian Trail. She was not on it, but she was close. However, there was never a connection made there. In the aftermath of Luis's murder, the authorities advised hikers to have a companion and to leave a detailed itinerary behind. While law enforcement had no specific reason to believe the killer would strike again, until caught, there's always a risk. While violent crime was a rarity, in the years leading up to Luis's murder, car break-ins had become a common issue in the area. In particular, trailhead parking lots were an easy target for wrongdoers since they could easily see approaching cars and most people were away from their car for a while when they were hiking. The police chief at the time of the nearby town of Jackson, John Kelly, said they had successfully reduced the car break-in issue, but said once you get to the area where Luis was found, the National Forest area, nobody was really patrolling, and many residents reported break-ins. The state police have a large area to cover, and according to the police chief, they were spread thin.
I'm sure that's just background information in terms of the type of crime that happens in the area that Luis was found, but have they tried to connect the two? Have they said this was potentially a carjacking or a robbery gone wrong?
No, they have never stated if they think that could be a factor in Luis's murder. I mean, I would hope they looked into anyone who was apprehended for breaking into cars and finding out where they were when Luis was murdered. Although going from breaking into cars to murder does feel like a pretty dramatic, drastic shift, but it just feels like it would need to be explored. Law enforcement has been intentionally tight-lipped about Luis's case, but they have revealed some tidbits of information. They share that there was evidence collected from the location of Luis's body. They haven't explained this evidence. However, they have indicated or alluded to the fact that they have some DNA evidence. This is not broadly mentioned, though. I only saw it in one or two articles.
Yeah, we know she fought her attacker based on the information you provided before. Maybe it was potentially something under her fingernails, or maybe she had a tuft of hair in her palms.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Could be something like that. Yeah. And anytime there's a struggle between the victim and the attacker, I think there's a greater chance of DNA transfer. So it is helpful in the investigation. There were three items that law enforcement knew from Luis's family that she brought to New Hampshire that were not found with her body or in her car. A sleeping bag was missing, which may have been attached to or inside a dark blue internal frame backpack with a Canadian insignia that was also missing, along with the keys to Luis's Ford Focus. The authorities urged anyone who came upon these items to come forward immediately. These are interesting items for the killer to take. My first theory was that the killer took her car keys that were presumably on her person when she was killed so they could search for items to steal from her car. But why would they steal her backpack and sleeping bag? There were no valuables inside the backpack, so I'm not sure. I mean, maybe they wanted the backpack and the sleeping bag was just attached to it and the keys were tucked inside the backpack. But the reason my brain was going that direction is because I don't see why Luis would be wearing that backpack during that hike. We don't even know 100% if she got the chance to start a hike, but if she did, her family and friends seem to think she would have just brought her small pack with chocolate and water, not this big backpack with a sleeping bag attached to it. Although I have seen it suggested that she may have wanted to test out hiking with this backpack because it wasn't her regular hiking backpack. With this case, it's just hard to piece together the order of events. We know she wanted to hike. We know she was found off a trail in the woods and some of her belongings were taken. But how does it come together to form a clear picture? There were no witnesses at all to offer any insight. I don't think there was anyone who even saw a suspicious person in the area. And I say I don't think because law enforcement could be holding that information back if it exists. But I don't see why that kind of tip would need to be held back.
All of this information makes me think that this whole situation happened right when she got there. She had just parked and someone came up to her and attempted this robbery. That's where they got the backpack. And like you said, it could have been, you know, the type of backpack that where the sleeping bag is attached to it. Because yeah, it doesn't make sense for her to bring this huge backpack on a half an hour hike unless she was just testing it out. But I think it's more likely that it happened as she parked and was getting out of her car and getting ready for the hike. And then this all unraveled. And then my thought is after this robbery, she was maybe attempted to run away and this person caught up with her. And then, you know, obviously it all went south from there. But yeah, that would explain why she didn't have her hiking boots on because she never got the chance to put them on. And yeah, it would explain the missing backpack.
I think that makes sense. Do you think if she started running, she would run toward the trail and up into the woods rather than to the road, though?
Yeah, I mean, maybe her thought was, if this person chases me, it'll be harder for them to find me if I go deep into the woods. Not sure.
Yeah, and also the thought of this person at targeting her to rob her and then chasing after her to stab her is pretty shocking. Obviously, it could happen, but otherwise, if that's not factored in here, then we would be talking about just a random murder.
Yeah, I mean, she probably got a really good look at this person if this was the case, right? And could have given a pretty good description to the police. They obviously didn't want that to happen.
Right. During that exchange, she would have gotten a good look at this person. The other scenario, what do you think about her being on the hike already and someone attacking her from there?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say I'd probably give it an equal likelihood. I mean, for all the reasons you mentioned above, maybe she was testing this backpack out. Since it was a short hike, maybe she didn't want to take the time to put on her boots and she just would have kept her sneakers on. The hike would have been probably more secluded than in the parking lot where there could have been other people. Mm-hmm. So this person could have seen this as an opportunity to rob her. Yeah, I'd say both are pretty equally likely.
Yeah, but I do think if we're factoring in robbery as a possible motive here, then at her car would make more sense. Like the attack starting at her car would make more sense to me than when she's already on the hike, because most hikers don't really carry valuables with them. I mean, when you're hiking, you're trying to pack as light as possible, so you wouldn't have items like that most likely. So if I were getting into the mind of someone who would do this, I wouldn't think someone hiking would be a good target. The other thing that's strange here is that she was found in a clearing. I mean, I know there were leaves over her body, but they didn't make a concerted effort to hide her necessarily. So it kind of seems like they just wanted to get out of there as fast as possible. This whole thing just feels very frenzied and chaotic to me. The investigators had to explore the scenario that someone from Quebec followed Louise down to New Hampshire to harm her. But a 2.5 to 3 hour drive would be quite the distance for someone to follow Louise without her taking notice. The police in Quebec helped look into this theory, and law enforcement met with Border Patrol officers and reviewed records to determine if anyone entered the border shortly after Louise or if anyone was with her, and they received no leads there. So it appeared that Louise was alone when she crossed the border in Vermont and was not closely followed by anyone. Louise's boyfriend, family, friends, and colleagues were interviewed and looked into, and one by one, they were ruled out. Again, they would have had to cross the border the same day as Louise, and there should have been a record of that, and there wasn't. No one in Louise's inner circle is considered a person of interest or suspect, but one area they focused on was Louise's work. As stated early on in the episode, Louise had recently started working with inmates at a local detention facility who were operating undercover as police informants. One of Louise's colleagues feared that Louise may have touched on something that someone didn't like and her killer followed her to the United States. But after looking deeper into Louise's professional life, they made no such connection to her murder. With each person in her life or each personal theory that was ruled out, law enforcement began to feel increasingly confident that Louise's killer was completely unknown to her and she was targeted randomly by someone who encountered her in the area where she was found. So she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. One other possibility is that someone spotted her at the gas station and convenience store she stopped at in Colebrook, New Hampshire. They'd still have to follow her for about an hour and a half, so it doesn't seem super likely, but as far as I'm aware, it hasn't been ruled out. Louise's family and friends worked hard to make sure she was not forgotten. They circulated flyers about her case, planted flowers where her body was discovered, coordinated a memorial walk, and participated in interviews with the media, often around the year marks of her murder, whether it be the 1 year, 2 year, 10 year, 20 year mark. They wanted to remind people that they were still searching for answers and won't stop until there's a resolution. Very little new information has come out over the years, but at the 10 year mark in 2011, law enforcement indicated they had a person of interest in Louise's murder. They quickly followed with cautioning people to not get too hopeful about that because over the course of the investigation, they've had several persons of interest, some of whom were ruled out while others hadn't been crossed off the list yet. They said they almost never actually name persons of interest or suspects in their investigations, and they have followed that pattern in Louise's case. At that 10-year mark, they were still requesting someone who had come across Louise's missing items to come forward. They said they know it's been so long that it's unlikely someone will come to them, but they wanted people to know that despite the passage of time, they should still feel encouraged to come forward with any information they have. And you wonder, where did those items go? Did the killer discard them on the side of the road or in a dumpster? Maybe the offender brought these items home and kept them. If they did that, then someone they knew could have seen Louise's belongings in their home. This is a perfect example of information someone could have that they don't realize is relevant. They may have seen these items around the time of Louise's murder, thought it seemed a little odd, especially if they saw the car keys. And if the investigators had that information, that could be very helpful. Of course, it doesn't prove anything necessarily, but it could be solid supporting information. I haven't seen many theories on why someone would have targeted Louise. I know we talked about robbery as a potential motive, but one detail her family has pointed out is that if someone made a remark to Louise in passing, maybe she was hiking, someone made a derogatory remark as they passed her, she would snap back at that person with no issue. So there could have been an exchange of words that led to an altercation that led to murder. And as I said before, Louise's murder just feels kind of frenzied and chaotic. It doesn't feel like someone planned out their actions. It feels a little more opportunistic. But ultimately, Louise was most likely killed by a stranger, and the nature of her murder was very violent, and it occurred in broad daylight in a public place. It's alarming to think that this dangerous person could still be out there today.
I know we haven't talked about it much, but I'm pretty interested in the visitor center clerk. This person would have known pretty much exactly where Louise was going to be at a certain time. And this person was the last one to see her alive.
Yeah, I had the same thought. I wasn't going to bring it up, but since you did, I was wondering the same thing. Like, has this man been looked into? Because in any case, we talk about the last person to see someone alive is almost always at the top of the list, at least to be ruled out. Like that person has to be ruled out. So I wondered, or I had the same questions, right? Did anyone have eyes on this clerk? And I don't feel too bad saying it because we don't know his name. We know nothing about him. I have no idea who this guy is, but I have to imagine he was on their list to look at.
Yeah, and maybe the evidence that they collected at the crime scene was DNA based, and they, you know, they checked that against the clerk and they cleared him.
Yeah, you know, that's possible.
I think that's a possibility.
Yes, it could be that they were able to compare the DNA collected from the scene to him and it ruled him out. It could very well be that that was how they were able to rule him out if they have. At the 20-year mark, according to the Concord Monitor, Louise's younger daughter, Constance, said at the time of her mom's murder, at 10 years old, she was too young to process the act and the finality of it. She never got to know her mom as an adult, but Louise wrote letters to Constance starting when she was pregnant, and she'd been reading through those because Louise wrote them to her as an adult. When I heard that, I thought, Louise writing these letters was so endearing. How special for Constance to have these letters to look back on now and understand her mom differently from how she knew her when she was 10. That's just a different experience. Louise's eldest daughter has said she has kids now, and it's hard to explain why their grandma is not in the picture. She can't really explain it until they're old enough. The family will not stop searching for answers until the truth is uncovered. So if you have information related to the murder of Louise Chaput, please contact the New Hampshire Cold Case Unit at 603-271-2663. You can also email the Cold Case Unit at coldcaseunit@dos.nh.gov. With this most likely being a random killing, I fear it could go unsolved. But at the same time, law enforcement has been tight-lipped, so they have more than we know, but clearly not enough to solve the case yet. I'm just hoping the physical evidence they have could end up being the key. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode. Please don't forget to rate, review, and follow the podcast wherever you're listening, especially follow. That really helps us out. And let us know what you think on this case. It's quite a head scratcher. So you can tell us what you think on Instagram or email us, whatever your preferred method is. But that is all for now. We will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.